Hi, everyone, and welcome. This is Seek Sustainable Japan. I'm JJ Walsh here in Hiroshima, joined by...
Hi, I'm Tova Kinoka, usually in Yokohama, but today coming to you from London.
It's so nice to connect, even though we're on other parts of the world, other time zones. It's a lovely afternoon, beautiful weather here in Hiroshima now. We're not seeing any autumn colors yet, but it's nice and cool. I'm even wearing long sleeves, which is quite the change from even a week ago. It was so warm, so.
Right, we've been having winter coats.
Oh, yeah, winter coats soon.
it's blue skies here this morning, but yesterday it was really pretty chilly and we were sort of out and about in the big winter coats. So definitely a bit of a... bit of a difference to back in Japan, but yeah, it's looking nice today. And the autumn colors are out here, so it's beautiful everywhere when the sun's out particularly.
How fantastic. Oh, you'll have to share some photos. Now this first picture here, you've got a really big event coming up. Congratulations. Your business, Global Perspective, is celebrating 10 years. Well done.
Thank you very much. I wasn't expecting you to bring that up, but we're very happy to have made it that far. It's been an interesting journey, particularly through COVID and stuff, but thanks to a lot of amazing people who've helped us and supported us along the way. So very happy and lucky to be there.
That's fantastic. And one of the reasons you're in the UK now, you're going to be going to One Young World once again. Where is it this year? Is it Munich, you said?
It's Munich this year. So I'm in London this week for a bunch of meetings with partners and clients, and then head to Munich at the weekend, and then the summit's next week. So really looking forward to that.
That's awesome. And just for people who haven't heard of it before, you want to just give us a little overview? What kind of event is it?
Yep. So One Young World is a UK-based NPO, and every year it convenes a huge summit for young leaders sort of in the 18 to 30 age group from around the world. So it's usually about 2,500 young leaders from every country in the world. And they come together around themes, sustainability related themes. So everything from gender equality through to circular economy is a big theme this year. All kinds of sort of spin-off topics from the big ones as well. This year, anti-hate is on the agenda, which is the first time we've seen that come up. So it's always a very, very, what shall I say, inspiring, but also kind of it hits home. These are real people with real stories. There are some incredible young leaders who've been through things that most of us can't possibly imagine and have come through it stronger and are making an incredible impact wherever they are in the world. And they come together also with business leaders and visionaries from the political, business, activism spheres all over. So it's an amazing, intense 4 days and something I really look forward to every year.
That's fantastic. I mean, that whole concept of resilience and how do you overcome adversity in life and not only keep moving forward, but do it in such a proactive, positive way to try to help other people, help the community, but also the environment. So many wonderful themes always come out of that.
Yep. So I'll happily report on what I learn and hear next time. It's a life-changing experience, I think, for the people that we take there for the first time. And still, I mean, for me, I think this is the sixth year that we've been. And it's always just, incredibly impactful. So,
dose of
inspiration.
And it looks like we have Natasha here. She is a regular for our 30-minute segment. Great to see you here, Natasha. Yesterday I had the chance to go and see a 600-year-old beautiful traditional house in this gorgeous little valley. And what really struck me when I went to visit, I was invited to go see it because the family has been managing it over the years, but they're living in Tokyo and they just are really struggling to keep coming down to the rural Hiroshima area and keep managing it. And when I came into this valley, and it's not too far from the highway, it takes about an hour drive from Hiroshima. But when you come in the valley, it's just quiet. And all you see is traditional houses and beautiful, like agricultural fields, rice paddies, and mountains. And it's just so rare to see this kind of village. So I'm not sure, you know, I'll try to use my network, and I'm going to the Minka Summit next week, or the Minka Con. So I'll be able to talk to people who are interested in old houses. But it really does seem like, you know, a lot of places like this, they're just really hoping someone who sees it can find a way to use it. Maybe it would be perfect for like a family or a creative person who wants to work from there. But it was a Shinto priest's house. Through the generations, they had a bunch of Shinto priests in their family legacy. And you can see here how it's covered in metal. And yeah. So this means it used to be thatch, the straw roof. And so I'm seeing Alex Kerr, the amazing Alex Kerr, tomorrow. So it'll be wonderful to talk to him and be able to get some insights from him, like how much would that kind of project cost, have that kind of understanding. But already, even after sharing it yesterday, I've had so many people contacting and showing interest. So it's a really good feeling to feel like, well, you could match interested people with the owners, and hopefully they'll be able to pass it on. I think we're at this place in Japan now where a lot of owners are saying we're happy kind of taking any reasonable offer, like even if it's, you know, almost nothing, as long as it's someone who's going to use it and bring life back to it. So it's really rare, right? Because most of the world, you just don't have enough housing. And it seems like Japan is one of the rare places where we actually have these decent, you know, well-made old houses and wonderful properties that could be for the taking for someone who wants to live, especially rural Japan, right?
I think, the rural areas really have been struggling, or still are struggling, right? Because of everyone sort of flooding into the cities where the work is. But now with, you know, the possibility of remote work being so much more sort of normal, I think it really does open up that as an option to go and live somewhere incredible like that. I mean, who wouldn't want that view waking up every morning? It's gorgeous. To be able to have that quality of life there as well. So I really hope it will attract more people to go and revitalize those rural communities as well, because they're beautiful places. They just need some people to keep them.
And so it'll be really nice to be at the Minka Con in Aichi next week, from November 7th to 9th. And there's so many wonderful speakers that they have again this year, and just to be able to meet so many wonderful people, and then we'll be able to see some of the artisans in action, as well as talking about their beautiful projects. So it's always an inspiration to go to things like that. I'm looking forward to it. Now you, this month, in the beginning of the month, you also went to two different events in Tokyo. Can you tell us about those?
Yes. So we've had sort of bunch of things going on in Tokyo. I can't remember which was first on our list, but the Tech for Impact Summit probably was the first one. And that brought together a really interesting mix of people. So sort of organized by Socius, and in particular, Seira Yun, who did an amazing job of bringing together some really, really interesting speakers, entrepreneurs, VCs, people from large corporates. So we had lots of different angles, and they were looking at how companies are currently using tech for positive impact, both environmental and social. But also, obviously, that, you know, the big questions are around, you know, what about the drawbacks from this, and what do we need to be careful of in terms of environmental impact and ethical issues as well. So there were some really great discussions there. I think one of the highlights, a couple of highlights for me, there was an amazing panel with entrepreneurs, and our friend Mariko McTia from MyMizu was one of the speakers on that. and talking about how sort of startups really need to be able to tell their story, not just talk about the product or the service that they're creating, but actually what's your story? Why are you doing this? Why is this important? And really having that story ready to tell. And then Audrey Tang, kind of legendary Audrey Tang from Taiwan, was just such a fascinating discussion with her, talking about diversity and also the sort of adaption of technology to sort of different uses and needs and the concerns that we have. And she's advising, I think, the Taiwanese government on how to roll things out there. And she had this wonderful comment that was, you know, you don't need to wait until you've got your idea perfect. She said, you know, and a less than perfect idea, put it out there, and that can be an invitation to somebody to continue the conversation. And I thought that was a really nice way of looking at it, worrying, you know, rather than worrying about, have I got it right yet? And is this idea ready to share? And am I going to look an idiot because I haven't thought it all through yet? So I just get it out there. And that's an invitation to others to then sort of pick up on the conversation and help you maybe uncover the things that you're not seeing. So it was very inspirational. We saw a lot of companies that are sort of super innovative, addressing issues like food waste and inequality. So that was a very inspiring day. And then I think it was 2 days later, we had the ICEF, which is the Innovation for Cool Earth Forum.
I'd never heard of that. Is that a new? Is that a new one?
15 years. But I only heard of it because a friend of mine, an amazing tech sort of entrepreneur from Singapore, she's speaking on one of the panels, so that's how I heard about it, went along. So it was very different vibe to the Tech for Impact. There were a lot of government representatives, a lot of academic research side of things, looking at different technologies, particularly around batteries and energy storage, carbon capture. So I learned a lot there. It was brilliant. I was frantically scribbling notes. But it was really interesting because I think we see a lot of things in the media about sort of whether carbon capture is the good thing or whether, you know, should we be looking at actually just reducing it at source and this, that, and the other. And the sort of takeaway I got was that we need both. We're not able to reduce fast enough in order to bring down the levels as much as we need to, as quickly as we need to. But these sort of direct capture technologies that are there are also necessary, but they're very different. And so they had experts talking about the different types there. Unfortunately, my notes are back on my desk in Tokyo, so I can't share any specifics right now. but it was super interesting because I think I didn't have much sort of technical knowledge and capture side of things, types there.
I was just listening. Harvard Business School does a great podcast. I think it's called Climate Rising. And they interview they interview a lot of people who have done their MBA program. And once they're out in the world working in interesting industries, all sustainably related. Yeah. And they had a woman talking about carbon capture. And it's so technical and confusing. But, you know, the more you listen to it, the more you understand how varied it is. Like there's so many different techniques. There's so many different ways to capture carbon. And then how is it used? And then some initiatives or innovators are capturing it, but not using it. That would be a different company. You know, it's much more complex than you would realize.
Exactly. So that was super interesting. A lot of learnings on that. And I think it would be helpful for more people to be aware of what these differences are. Otherwise, you just kind of tend to lump them all in one bucket, right? And just so label it good or bad, depending on sort of what you've heard about it, but not really realize that, like you say, there are all these different ways of doing it. And maybe they have different applications, depending on the location or the industry and so on. And to be honest, we need a lot more innovation and you know, sort of activity in this space. So
we need people talking about it. So having events like the one you went to, having podcasts about it, getting people to try to dumb it down, you know, like people inside these industries, they've got all this tech jargon and everything. So sometimes it's really hard to understand what was that acronym again, you know?
Kind of
Google it while you're listening, you know?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. There was quite a lot of that going on, I think.
Or I need a cheat sheet for all the terms that they're using, you know?
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, no, it'd be super helpful.
Yeah, kind of on the other end of the scale, I had a great talk this month with Phil and Kyle. Now, Kyle has been on the show before. Kyle Holzhuter, he does Permaculture Center Kamimomi in Okayama, which is right next to Hiroshima. And he's working, collaborating with Phil Cashman, who is based in Chiba, and he does permaculture and urban farming. We've both talked to John Walsh, who does a lot of similar things. And he's really passionate about how can you grow more things in your tiny kitchen in urban spaces, you know, really practical stuff. And so they're doing a really fun looking event coming up called Living Earth Lab. And it's like a week long seminar in Okayama, where they'll be doing a variety of things, from harvesting trees sustainably to using lumber to doing natural plastering, building, but also talking about all those wonderful concepts of permaculture. What does that mean? How does it interplay with the Satoyama, the traditional ideas of using water flows and living in harmony with nature and stuff? So it just sounds so good, and I'm so sad I can't go. But it was great catching up with them. We had a very lively, fun chat. Phil is very enthusiastic about compost toilets, which was really fun to talk about. Yeah. But, you know, like the house I visited yesterday.
Right.
That's an issue in the middle of nowhere in these old houses. He said that would be something the owner would have to deal with, is now it's a pit toilet. Yeah. And then the trucks have to come by and section out what's in there. But if you got comfortable with even, like Phil was talking about, microflush and having a compost toilet, which acts like a modern toilet, and it's not the pit, it's much more comforting for people who aren't quite ready for that, really out in the middle of the woods by yourself kind of experience. Like, you can make it modern, and you know, so I was thinking about that yesterday, so that was that was really good learning.
Brilliant. So we visited New Zealand about, I don't know, 6-7 years ago, and there were quite a few places, particularly in the sort of rural areas there as we were traveling around, that were using composting toilets. I thought it was just and they were great. They didn't smell, they were perfectly comfortable and convenient. So
And it really, if you're thinking of planning a house, it frees you up in terms of your design so much. If you don't have to make a sewage line, or you don't have to get a truck to come and suction it out, right? It can really develop into a much more natural and sustainable and beautifully and comfortably designed house, right? So it is worth talking about, even though it's, you know, uncomfortable for many people.
I grew up on a farm, so for me it's not too much of an issue, but I can imagine for some people it's a bit weird.
That's funny. I also had the chance to talk with Toru Muramatsu, who is the CEO of Chiori Alliance, and Alex Kerr founded that with his beautiful house in Ia Valley, Chiori. And then it developed into this Chiori Alliance. And so they have multiple traditional houses made into guest houses and different projects around. But it was interesting talking to Toru and hearing his ideas about how he studied in America. And then he realized I have a lot of interest in Japanese culture, and then coming back and working with traditional furniture, and then now working with traditional houses. And it's so nice to talk to someone who has that U-turn. And I'm sure in one world, this conference, that you see a lot of people like that who go and educate abroad, and then they want to come back and apply it in Japan or where they're from.
Exactly. Solve the challenges they see around them that maybe they're looking at now with a different perspective. So I think that kind of experience is really valuable.
Yeah, absolutely. And just some insights from, I don't think we've talked since I went to the Netherlands and saw my
No.
son. And just some of the great initiatives that I saw at work there. For example, this recycle station for everything from clothing to appliances to everything you could buy at a department store that you can take back to
That's
recycle
brilliant.
at the department store. So it's just such
Fantastic.
a great, like, simple idea. Where do people buy this stuff? Well, we need to have a reuse recycling station right there. And this is something definitely I thought we could apply in Japan too, right?
Very much. That's clever thinking, right? It's sort of the infrastructure is often the problem for recycling and getting stuff back, right, at end of use. So that's, just a really practical, very, very Netherlands in that sense, just very practical solution.
Right, but also making it free and easy to do, like not making it so difficult to take usable stuff back somewhere. Like there are some clothing stores, for example, like Uniqlo, who will take clothing back, but it has to be Uniqlo, right? And then there's others that are kind of like that. So why not just have it at the department store? Everything you can buy here, well, you can bring it right back and somebody else can use it, or somebody can fix it, like what a great idea.
No, that's fantastic.
And then I saw these water refill stations everywhere in malls and stations. Definitely something we want to see more of. #MyMizu, let's go find
Yes.
those. And then this was really interesting. These are compressing garbage under the street. So you have garbage, recycling and garbage, different bins. And then you see there's like an antenna on the top. And so it alerts the ma waste management when it needs to be emptied, but it can store so much more under the ground and it compacts it. And so I was thinking in Japan, where we're having labor issues, definitely this is a great idea, especially for urban spaces. It keeps it nice and clean. That would work in Tokyo, I think.
Very practical again.
Now, I've been talking a lot. What is another one that you wanted to talk about? Do you remember?
Where are we up
What else was
to?
on your list?
So
Oh,
the other thing.
you had an interesting one, Fabula.
So this is something actually my daughter put me onto yesterday. So she does a monthly sort of newsletter on a different topic, and this month she's looking at food waste. And she came across this company, Fabula, in Japan, out of the University of Tokyo, I believe, that are using food waste, drying it out, then sort of making the dried out mess, sort of waste into a kind of a powder, and then compressing that under heat to produce all kinds of interesting items, including sort of building materials. It's incredible, and they can use it for sort of plates and cups and things like this. So it's really, really fascinating. And as you can see, they can use all different kinds of incredibly strong, dried out and compressed into this sort of new form. It's incredibly strong. Of course, it's fully biodegradable because it's just made from food. I think it's not live commercially yet, but hopefully we'll be there soon. But it's fantastic to see innovation like that coming out, and just think of the possibilities of that. And if it can be used instead of concrete, for example, which is one of the things that they talk about on their website, then think of the impact that could have, positive impact in terms of reducing carbon footprint and pollution and so on. So that's a really interesting company.
That sounds amazing. Yeah, I love hearing about those kind of innovative ideas. And that reminds me of this article from Tamago, Spoon and Tamago. Do you know them?
Yeah.
Such a great business, and they highlight different, like, interesting Japanese culture things every month. And this month they had teary-eyed stickers that you might see at Family Mart to encourage people to buy the food before it goes off. So as it's nearing its sell-by time, especially for rice balls and perishables, they put these cute little stickers on that have teary eyes and tell you the discount, but encouraging you to buy me before it's too late, you know?
Yeah.
And they said in their research, the Family Mart convenience store did research, and people were saying, oh, not only I was thinking about the discount, but also it made me think about food loss, about wasting food and how it's important not to. And they reckon they've saved like 3,000 tons or something. And so they're now giving away the stickers for free. If you have an eatery that wants to use them, they're happy if you use the same stickers. So it sounds like a great initiative.
Yeah, that's such a good idea. And again, just simple behavioral science applied in a really practical way. So,
And of course, cute. Everything has to be cute in Japan. Otherwise, it won't work.
If it works, let's do it.
And then another one I was really drawn to was this temporary housing award from the Noto earthquake. A wonderful design team was making traditional style Japanese houses that fit together without the need for nails or adhesives. And so they're very simple temporary housing, but really they're beautiful and they're strong and promoting traditional Japanese culture. So I'll put a link to that below. And such a beautiful idea.
Yeah. No, that looks great. Much better than some of the boxes we saw that just looked like sort of, I don't know, shipping containers basically.
I mean, it's great when you see those reuse of shipping containers, but with the long hot summer that we just had, that would not be comfortable to live in, right?
No, exactly. So, and particularly when people are in these things, not just for a few weeks or something, this is months and months and months, sometimes years that we're talking about. So,
Was there anything else you had on your list, Tova?
I think the only other thing was just a point about, so we visited yesterday, or I visited one of our partner companies, Insights, which is a psychometric assessment that we use. And I noticed that at the front of their car park, because it's in the middle of nowhere, so public transportation isn't an option there. But at the front of their car park was a whole line of electric cars all plugged in. Like, interesting. So I asked the staff about them, and they said, yes, the company incentivizes them and gives them some support if they want to buy an electric vehicle. It gives them space and free charging facilities right at the front of the car park, nearest the office. So it was just good to see a company encouraging and supporting their employees to make sort of better choices there like that. If you have to drive, then the electric vehicles obviously going to be better than fossil fuel vehicles, and then to see them infrastructure, which is often a problem, but access to the infrastructure for charging and things can be a real issue. So I was really impressed to see that happening there.
Oh, that's great. I think Japan, we're right now just on the cusp of the electric car revolution here. We have a fantastic charging network in Japan. So we already have that foundation that so many other countries are really struggling to get. We just need a few more of the Japanese car companies to get in on it. But it please. Sounds like they are now.
Getting there slowly.
Yeah, we had some nice comments from Natasha. I want to be composted when I die. Environmentally friendly green burial. I like that idea. I do. I told my kids, just put me in a planter with a nice tree. Or if you're happy with me being in a tree in your garden, I'd like that.
Yep. You know? exactly. Just returning to the earth is part of the circle of life. Then,
it's
wonderful.
It's kind of the way it should be, right? Yeah. And then Des Lewis just joined us. The teary-eyed stickers, great idea. Indeed, visibly inviting. And I think that's a way to go in terms of encouragement. Very great idea. The underground compressor, why can't it be in another color or pattern? Good ideas. Let's keep talking about it.
Yeah.
But yeah, why not? I mean, it could blend into your city street. It could add artistically to your community. Why not? I love that idea.
Yeah.
So that's about our time. Tova, I know you're super busy there. You got lots of meetings going on. Always great to connect with you. And we'll try to do it again next month.
Brilliant. Looking forward to it.
All right. Thanks, everyone, for joining. And take care. See you again next time. Bye, everyone.
Bye.